This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we have a couple of our Friday favorites as Matt O'Lean reviews the new Cruella film. And we have our news discussion with Dave Thompson. But we are going to start today with UND Distinguished Professor of Philosophy, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. The upcoming episode airs this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central as he and his guest discuss the politics of crisis, how police reform, COVID-19, and climate change are all related. Jack, thanks for your time today.
It's always a pleasure.
Tell us about your guest. How did you find this guy who's pretty young but making waves?
I was looking for someone who had a global point of view, who had a sense of how to make sense of it all. There's so much going on, and it all feels disparate. What's happening in Minneapolis, what's happening around the world, what's happening, you know, in our own homes. And I just look at all the philosophers and find someone who's interesting, and Femé is a super compelling guy.
And you are more aware of him, if I'm not mistaken, for the publications that he writes for versus the kind of philosophy that he is a professor of?
Yeah, he's very interesting because in addition to doing his academic work, he's out of Georgetown. His full name is Olafemi Taiwo, and he's out of Georgetown. But he also publishes in the New Republic and Slate and this sort of online magazine called Aeon. And it was really interesting to me to get somebody who was more of a public political figure than just someone who's working on super scholarly stuff.
Mm. You know, what was interesting to me about the episode is a lot of the conversation deals with the word radical. And then you have a guy who was very academic, very calm, had a lot of facts at his disposal. And it's funny because even I, and I know better, but even I don't associate that word radical with calm. And you talk about radical, someone being radical in really only a negative context, and specifically people who, for example, are critical of capitalism or are critical of American democracy. And I'm wondering, why is the recognition that a system isn't perfect considered radical?
Well, so that's a great question. And we talked a bit about the word and the power of the word. Of course, right, people who use radical as a criticism use it negatively, but people who are self-described radicals actually say it positively, mm-hmm. right? That it's a badge of honor. And the thing about being radical is that what people want is mass change quickly, right? Being a critical, being a liberal or a conservative, you have more narrow opinions, but a radical is looking at the whole system and looking at it at it collectively, and the change might seem a little more jarring than something that a more centrist person would hold. But radical is also really contextual, because a lot of things that we think are radical, many people think aren't. So, for example, healthcare, right? In the United States, the idea that the government should assist with healthcare and that people shouldn't be bankrupt for their hospital visits is radical, whereas in almost every other country in the world, it's the starting point, right? Mm-hmm. And so who's more radical, the people who have, quote, socialist healthcare, or the one of three or four countries that says, no, you have to pay for it yourself, right? And so radical is really contextual based on the system that you're in. There was a time when women wearing pants was considered radical. Right.
Right. Well, yeah, I want to talk about the idea that the word radical probably has an expiration date. A couple of years ago, PBS American Experience had something on women's suffrage. It was in honor of the 100-year anniversary. And they talked about how the fight for that took almost 100 years of some well-behaved women asking men very nicely to give them the same amount of rights that they had. And then you get into the part where there were radicals, people who were considered radicals at the time because they had much more dramatic tactics. And they said you couldn't really have gotten the right to vote without both approaches. But I'm not sure anybody considers those people radical anymore.
You're absolutely right. When we look at the history of political movement, at political change, the folks who were at the fringe, the folks who were most radical, are often very centrist right now. Let me give a more recent example. For many years at UND, in my introduction to ethics class, we had a conversation about gay marriage, you know, the ethics pro and con and blah, blah. And I would show a movie, a wonderful movie with Robin Williams called Birdcage. And then about 7-8 years ago, I stopped doing it because it just wasn't controversial anymore.
It's just, you know, go back to the original French.
Yeah, that's a rougher version. But the students, not only are they not shocked or upset by it, they just don't care. It's just, and that's the mark of the change. It's not that they all have the same opinion. It's just that, yeah, sure, gay marriage, whatever. There are always a couple students mm-hmm. who come from very conservative religious backgrounds who object to gay marriage, but now they're the radicals, right? Because 99% of the other students are like, yeah, gay marriage, sure, what else is on TV, you know?
Sure.
Even within the time, you know, even within the last decade, we can see, right, marijuana legalization, right? That it may not be everywhere, but no one thinks it's radical anymore. They might think it's wrong,
yeah,
but that's a different issue.
I mean, it's a college degree at this point.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, not exactly that, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, couldn't a definition of a radical be anyone who has a view diametrically opposed to your own?
It's a little more than that. A radical is someone who wants significant mass change quickly, right? That's what a radical is. Now, something that appears radical and negative will be in opposition to your point of view, but still, let me try to explain this on the radio. When I talk about these sorts of things in class, I draw a line, you know, a sort of left to right line. And each on the left and the right have extremes, right? Revolutionary on one hand, reactionary on the other. Those are the extremes left and right. And then there's – if you're going from the left to the right, you go from revolutionary to liberal to centrist to conservative to reactionary. And radical is the far end of either of those spectrums because mm-hmm. it's something that feels like a massive change and that undermines the foundation. But if you think the foundation of our political system needs to be undermined, then it's a good thing. If you don't, it's a bad.
The episode talks a lot about different crises. You talk about the pandemic, you talk about climate change, you talk about police reform. And the whole point of having this specific guest is to tie those all together. What is the golden thread that he ends up weaving?
So what I found the most fascinating about the discussion is the reversal in how we're supposed to think about it. Because in general, we tend to think about here are the crises, here's the pandemic, here's police reform, and what are the consequences? And so the society is going to respond to the crisis. But what he wants us to understand first is that the crisis is a response to society. That it, in order to fix the crisis, it's not that we have to be reactionary or reactive. We have to be proactive. We have to fix the what he calls the background material conditions, how much stuff we have. In the end, his conclusion is this is all about us fulfilling our individual needs. And when we give more people stuff and we provide more people with access to resolving their needs, then the crises go away. So it shouldn't be crisis driven. It should be structural, social, cultural, institutional. And then the crises are going to go away.
It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Absolutely. So there are definitely things that people need first: food, water, shelter,
right,
safety. And then the further you go up on this hierarchy, then you need – then there's conveniences and then there's luxuries.
You know, it's true. I do see that even in my own life, how much harder going through my own life is if I'm hangry, for example, or just not had enough water when it's 102 degrees and suddenly everything feels like a crisis where you take a step back, have some water, have some cucumbers, whatever. And suddenly, and this is a ridiculous oversimplification, and I understand that, but suddenly it's not as much of a crisis. It feels like something you can manage. Is he saying that not it's just going to go away, but it becomes much more manageable if we start with just the baseline?
Sure. So let's take the following situation, right? Let's take you're driving across town and there's a lot of traffic and you run out of gas and it's just a terrible day. Mm-hmm. If you get to go home after that to a calm home with food, with water, with people you love, and you have the money to make the repairs, then it's frustrating and it's a nuisance. Mm-hmm. But if that happens and you go home and you have no water or you don't have the money to pay for the repairs or you're in a situation of violence, then it becomes infinitely worse. And so part of what happens is that when your needs are met, you have the tools and the resources to deal with the crises, the unexpected things. And so, again, instead of creating immediate responses to the stuff that's happening, we need to look at people's basic needs and basic justice and basic empathy and give people the strength to deal with the stuff that comes and undermines their life. Because again, right, there are things that can happen to me if my life were just a little more tenuous, if I had a little less money, if something happened to me, I'd be destitute, right? There are people for whom if they break their foot, they lose their job and they starve and die, right? And there are other people for if they break their foot, well, then they get to hang out in their backyard and drink beer, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's those basic material conditions, the background circumstances that allow us to respond to what comes our way.
Does this mean then that all of the academic approach, all of this sort of well-meaning white liberal, let's talk about this and let's address this on an academic level and the way we teach it in schools. Is this a matter of the road to hell is paved with good intentions? Is this all worthless?
This was one of the pivot points in the discussion that I found tremendously fascinating, right? And it's not so much the academic liberal approach. It's that we as Americans focus on ideas more than we focus on material goods. So let's take the following situation. You have two people who live together, one person in a huge house, you know, with lots of resources, and one person in a tiny house with plumbing problems and no heat and feels very, very vulnerable. The first person in the big house is, in the example, racist, and the second person in the second house is black. In our society, we think that curing the person of the racism, of their racism, is the most important thing. If we can just get them to stop being racist, things will be better. Mm-hmm. But what Femme says is that's backwards. Focus on the house. Focus on the inequality. Give the person in the house without plumbing, plumbing. Give them heat. Make sure that they have the resources, and two things will happen. First, the racism will be less powerful, and second, the person is going to care much less about the racism because the rest of their life is fine. Mm. You know, there are lots of people who don't like me, but it's not that important because they don't have power over me. And so as Americans, we have gotten to the point where our attitudes are what we're focused on when, as he puts it, it's all about the stuff. If we can give people stuff, the attitudes become much less important.
That seems a bit opposed to just the way Americans view themselves, which is the rugged individualism, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. It goes against everything we tell ourselves about who we are.
And this, too, is where the sort of radical nature of his conversation comes in, because I asked him that very question, and his point was America has never been radically individualist. America likes to tell itself that story, but in fact, when the colonists came to North America, they couldn't do it by themselves, so they had to have slaves, and they had to bring immigrants, and they had to have indentured servants who did the work for them. And if we look at the history of the United States, what it is not individuals being entrepreneurs and solving problems by themselves, but in his words, an elite class of people who are exploiting laborers and in order to get more stuff for themselves. And so we have this ideal of rugged individualism, but there's virtually no time in history and very few people for whom that's true.
Do you get the sense that your guest could ever get to the point where we need to stop talking about the legacy of colonialism, the legacy of slavery?
I don't think so at all. I think that part of what the legacy is an explanation as to why the system needs to be changed, right? If we, you know, if everyone were equal and if all systems were just and if everyone had the same rights and the same security and the same safety, then I think the story becomes less urgent or more of a historical interest. But sad to say, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, and I don't think my guest would think that either. So as long as there's inequality and as long as that inequality is divided up by color lines or gender lines, the history of how that happened is tremendously important. And that's why the stories that we tell about our history are also tremendously important because they help us make sense of where we got to today.
Well, you get into an interesting discussion about not just the story, but where the story starts.
Right.
Where you know, don't give away too many spoilers. We should have people listening to the episode coming up this Sunday at 5 o'clock. But where does he argue that the story of the United States really starts?
Well, I actually introduced the example very early on, so it's not too much of a spoiler, of the debate about the 1619 Project in the New York Times right now and Donald Trump's response to that, which was the 1776 Commission. Donald Trump and the people that he hired to write this report think that America begins at the Declaration of Independence. But the New York Times 1619 report argues that, no, America began, the true American founding is in 1619 when the first boat lands in Virginia with slaves. And you can, you know, you can see both sides, right? You can see why someone would want to call the Declaration of Independence the beginning of the United States, but if you do that, you can't explain the Declaration of Independence, right? You can't explain where Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin or John Hancock came from. If you start at the date of 1619, then you have a much more thorough story. But again, the 1776 Project tells the story of rugged individualism, the exceptional country that values liberty and freedom and justice for all. And what the 1619 Project does, and this is Femi's answer, is tells the true story that it's not justice for all and it's not ruggedly individualistic. And in the end, we just have to look at history and ask which is right and which is wrong and what the goal of telling one story over the other is.
Well, what about taking it back to 1492 when, and I'm going to use air quotes around the word discovered,
right.
Because obviously there had been people here for tens of thousands of years. And you could even argue, okay, maybe not America as we think of it, the United States of America, starting back that far, but certainly as part of that conquest period.
This is an example actually ripped from the headlines because we know about 2 weeks ago Rick Santorum stated publicly that the Native Americans didn't have any real effect on American culture and that there really weren't that many there.
Patently false.
Yeah, right. There were about 60 million people on the continent in 1492. And so he wants to tell the 1776 story in which the New World was a blank slate and the colonists came in and started this country from scratch. But that's not true. And so at the core of all of this, in addition to the justice questions, in addition to the practical questions, is the question of how do you tell a story and how important is it to tell truth in the face of ugliness? Some people don't want, right? So, you know, there are some parents who never admit to making mistakes to their children, who don't want to reveal their misdeeds when they were teenagers, who don't want to, you know, say that you know, they were having sex in high school or smoking pot or anything like that. And there are other parents who say, look, my kid has to know I'm flawed. My kid has to know I make mistakes. My kid has to know that I went through what they went through and that I came out okay. So if they do these things responsibly and carefully and talk to me about their mistakes, then they're going to be better people. And the question about heroes, the question about the story of the United States, the question about how we frame the narrative is that question writ large about our country, about our culture.
What do you think it is? And this, I don't know if this is a question for a philosopher or maybe this is more for a sociologist, but is there something that we can't admit about ourselves if we do try to go back farther than 1776?
I think there is something that's very hard for us to admit about ourselves. But also, and this is the question of the time, what does it mean to say it's ourselves? You know, I wasn't a slave owner. I didn't, engage in genocide in 400 years ago. But I do carry the legacy of that in the world that I live, in the schools that I go to, and the jobs that I have. And so how much do I identify with the people of the past? How much do I carry it with me? This is the question of the time. And how much are you responsible for what your ancestors did? In a certain sense, right? We all know that we should not be held accountable for the sins of our fathers, as the phrase goes. On the other hand, there's this idea of privilege, that because I am who I am and because I am where I am, you know, my house, which I own and care for and love, is on land that was taken from tribes. And so what does that mean for me? How does that change my life? How does that change my actions? The word privilege has become so politicized that I don't necessarily think that it's useful anymore, but it also gets the idea very clearly that because I have land that I bought from someone else who wasn't the original owner, I get benefits and advantages and privileges that the people who originally were on the land and it was taken from don't have. That's a reality, even if the word is problematic.
I know you love the word better and maybe the word worse then. Which would be worse, the recognition of privilege, of having guilt about privilege without any kind of action, or not at all recognizing that the privilege came from a deeply racist and sexist system?
Guilt in itself doesn't do very much, right? Just emotions in themselves aren't particularly helpful. It's how you respond to those emotions. It's how you act on those emotions. Some therapists I know always describe it as the following. They say you're 0% responsible for your feelings, 50% responsible for your thoughts, and 100% responsible for your actions, right? If you feel guilty, the question is, why do you feel guilty and what can you do about it? If you just walk around in a state of perpetual guilt, that's probably not helpful for anybody.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs this coming Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, as he and his guest, Olafemi Taiwu, discuss the politics of crisis, how police reform, COVID-19, and climate change are all related. Jack, thanks for your time today.
It's always great to talk to you.
Still to come on Main Street, a film review from Matt Olien. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The State Industrial Commission has approved $10 million to fund two legislatively directed research projects that could lead to more value-added energy development. The Energy and Environmental Research Center will conduct the research.
It's really fortuitous as the nation looks at decarbonizing.
EERC Director Charles Gorecki says creating a hydrogen economy is key to that.
Creating a roadmap for North Dakota for hydrogen and a hydrogen economy is going to be incredibly important so that we can make, as the state can make strategic investments and help others in industry make those strategic investments.
One study will look at the feasibility of creating salt caverns for hydrocarbon storage. Gorecki says that's going to be important for attracting the petrochemical industry as well as for storing hydrogen and other liquid fuels.
North Dakota doesn't have those at this point. We have salts that could be potentially very useful for that. And we're going to take a look at those by drilling into them, collecting the core, which we don't have at this point.
That study will cost $9.5 million. The other study looks at hydrogen energy development in North Dakota. Two companies recently announced a plan to produce so-called blue hydrogen at the Great Plains Synfuels plant. Gorecki says that plant is already a hydrogen plant.
Blue hydrogen is where we create it, usually using a fossil fuel source, and then capture the carbon dioxide and store it in the ground. States like North Dakota, we can do that. Minnesota, Iowa, places like that cannot because they don't have suitable geology.
The state's Oil and Gas Research Council will still have to complete a technical review before the studies can move forward. A consortium of agriculture, business, and healthcare groups are teaming up to try and increase COVID-19 vaccination rates among rural residents. Here's Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All.
With vaccination rates in rural counties still lagging behind urban centers, there's more focus on changing the message to convince vaccine-hesitant people to get a shot. The effort includes the American Farm Bureau. President Zippy Duvall says farmers and ranchers already know the benefit of vaccinations.
We all understand that as farmers and ranchers. The herd immunity really works, but we got to get to that 70% or higher level before we can feel like that we get to that point.
Duvall says it's important that rural communities hear encouragement from people they trust, namely local farm organizations, religious leaders, and businesses with a presence in rural areas. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
And the hot weather and accumulated nutrients can lead to blue-green algae blooms in lakes, rivers, and other bodies of water. And the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality is advising people to be aware of it. The algae may look like floating grass clippings, green cottage cheese, or make the water appear like a green paint or pea soup.
Primarily, they can cause issues, health concerns, both human health concerns as well as livestock and pets are the primary concerns.
Aaron Larson is with the DEQ's Division of Water Quality.
They can result in death of pets and livestock, unfortunately. As far as human health effects are concerned, we do get reports of blisters, nausea, those types of indigestion issues associated.
Larson says if you come across the algae, avoid it and report it to the DEQ. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, there's the old wire machine. That means it is time to talk to News Director Dave Thompson, who joins us once a week from our Bismarck studio to talk about the week's biggest stories. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome, Ashley. And I have a question for you.
What's that?
Have you ever changed the ribbon in one of those old teletype machines?
I have not. I don't know that I've ever seen a teletype machine.
Well, when I started in the business at KFJM in Grand Forks, when it was part of the University of North Dakota, we had not only that one, we had a weather wire teletype machine. And you had to change ribbons like you changed ribbons on a manual typewriter. So got a lot of ink. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, that sounds like a good gardener's fingernails. Like they should just always be black underneath your fingernails. You're
pretty
a good
much,
newsman if your fingernails are inky, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, this week's story is the Public Service Commission denying a delay for wind farm light replacement project. This is the latest on an ongoing situation here where there has been this half need to change the lights on wind turbines.
Correct.
Okay.
And what has happened? If you look at what's on wind turbine lights that, you know, they've been around for a while, it's those blinking red beacon lights. And people who live around wind farms complain that that's affecting the night sky. They can't see the stars and things like that. So they came up with a thing that's it's an aircraft light detection system. And anytime an aircraft would be in an area, that would turn on the lights. So when the aircraft passed, it would go back to darkness. Okay. Well, there was a thing called LIDS, which is a different situation that some wind farms are kind of looking at. Mm-hmm. However, this system, which would be a light, you know, a dimming system. Well, apparently there are some problems. The FAA has not approved it yet and is probably not ready to approve it yet without further testing. So, and we have a deadline in North Dakota that they have to change out all the old lights on the existing wind farms by the end of the year. So the Public Service Commission says we can't give you an extension because we don't know if LIDS is going to be approved.
Okay. And this was specific to the Rugby wind farm. This story, are there
Correct.
Other ones that have been looking into light intensity dimming system or LIDS?
Well, it's kind of interesting because there is one that's pending, and that was a wind farm that was pretty much south of Rugby that was looking at that because it didn't want the red beacons a-blinking, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, they thought this aircraft light detection system might be okay, but the Air Force raised concerns because if the lights go on, you know an aircraft's in the area and you probably don't want that.
Oh, sure.
So they were looking for LIDS, and LIDS is not being approved, so that is on hold.
Do we know how drones impact these lights? Like, would they trigger aircraft detection?
Yes, they okay. would. That's the way I understand it.
Okay. Another story this week, the Industrial Commission okaying a couple of studies for value-added energy development. I guess let's start with, you know, I'm aware of value-added when it comes to, like, what a chef can do to a baked potato that I can't. what's value-added energy development?
Well, this value-added energy development would be to separate hydrogen out of the hydrocarbons,
okay.
store the carbon underground, and number one, you make the hydrogen, because we're moving toward a hydrogen economy, at least that's what a lot of the experts say. You make the hydrogen, you know, be very attractive to those who want to use it for maybe generating electricity.
And when you say we're moving towards it, do you mean North Dakota or do you mean the nation?
The
or
nation
world?
Seems to be moving toward yeah. it. I don't exactly know how fast it's going, but there's a lot of discussion about hydrogen economy.
How do you store those?
Well, the hydrogen could be stored in salt caverns, or the CO2, the carbon dioxide, could be stored in salt caverns. And the thing is, you could store CO2 and use it for enhanced oil recovery or some other uses. Now, there's been a lot of talk about having a big greenhouses that can use CO2. Plants like CO2. So there's a lot of talk about that. They're looking for ways, because the feeling among most people is we're getting toward a carbon-constrained world, and then you've got the governor mm-hmm. saying that he would like to see carbon-neutral North Dakota by 2030.
This has been okayed for a couple of studies. The studies are for $9.5 million. The other $500,000, so half a million of the $10 million set aside for this, looks at hydrogen energy development. That seems like a very big discrepancy in spending.
I can tell you why that is, and you know, I probably should have included in the story, but you're familiar with the Core Library. They store you know, core samples. And what they want to do is take core samples of these salt caverns. Now, they don't have any samples right now.
Okay.
So you take the samples, and then businesses who might be interested in working with salt caverns for storage can go up to the Core Library, take a look at those samples, and say, okay, we can do this. And North Dakota is pretty good in terms of the geology here because we've got it, whereas some of our surrounding states do not.
We have another bit of information that is unfortunately not something we want to be going towards. The homicide rate in the state is going up. We set a record in 2020.
We certainly did, with 32, and it was 22 the year before. And lest you think it might be just from the oil patch and the population up there, no. Number one, Cass County with 9. Number two, Minot with 7.
Hmm.
Now, Attorney General Wayne Stengem says the whole trend is concerning. And I think back to some of the early days of my news reporting, where if you had 5 in a year, it was kind of,
wow.
Oh, that happens. But no, we've had a bit of an uptick, and there's taking a look at some of the root causes why, but they're not sure why this is happening.
Is it at all possible that some of this is related to 2020 being a really insecure world for a lot of people?
It's possible. The Attorney General is playing that down, but he says that it is possible that that could be, that there is a, you know, there's a lot of unrest these days.
Yeah. We do have some disaster response training, not to shootings, but to other things that could happen at, this is a fun story that Danielle did at the Fargo Airport, fire departments, police departments, ambulance, actors who were paid to be, and I quote, pains in the butt, which I was like, man, I could have done that. And the Oscar goes too. Is this just normal training for disaster response? Is this in light of changes?
Well, actually, it's more normal training. It's done every 3 years at airports.
Okay.
And it was Fargo's turn to do it. They hadn't done it for 3 years. And they really want to make sure that the response is up to snuff. And that's why they asked the actors to, you know, be pains in the behind when they come and, you know, try to get people out of the way or try to help people who are supposedly injured because of a plane accident. You know, and that's happening all over the country. And, you know, 3 years is a, you know, pretty aggressive timeline.
Speaking of airports, there are new flights coming out of the Williston Airport, or will be at some point?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, funny thing is, this is COVID-19 related too, because when COVID-19 really hit, the demand for air service, as you know, dropped precipitously.
Mm-hmm.
And in most airports, including in Williston, people were flying smaller planes, but in Williston, they actually Delta stopped its daily run between Minneapolis and Williston.
Mm.
But that's coming back, and they've been looking for more of a leisure carrier. That's why they went with Sun Country Airlines. And they said one of the big demands for flights is to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So they're going to start these twice-a-week flights to Las Vegas.
That is, I think, always the first one that gets added to any new airport.
Pretty much, yes, exactly.
It's Las Vegas, then it's Denver. Sometimes Orlando gets in there.
Or if you're talking about snowbird populations, it's
Phoenix
and Mesa, too.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's been $70 million set aside for career and technical education in the state of North Dakota. This is part of the COVID-19 relief money?
That is correct, and that is allowable under COVID-19 rules. Now, $70 million will allow a lot of school districts who may be getting it from distance learning things, from computers or from online things. They're going to be actually looking at some bricks and mortar facilities. I know there are several that are being proposed. For example, Dickinson's got one. They've got a building, but they need to do some renovation on the building.
Okay.
Fargo, of course, is talking about that one that's in partnership with the North Dakota State College of Science at Wahpeton, and that involves about four school districts there. But, you know, you look at the career academies, and that's what these are called, and you look at a Bismarck, which has
impressive.
It's a very impressive career academy. And that was done without any kind of federal money, but, you know, with the federal money available, they're taking advantage of it and looking at it. Now, what the Board for Career and Technical Education is doing is writing the rules on how you apply for these things. So there's going to be a formal process that's going to be put in place.
Is the building for this kind of education coming out of an increase in these kinds of jobs, or is it just those jobs have always been there, we just have never had the space to teach it?
It's a little bit of both, but I will tell you that there is an increase in demand for these types of jobs. You talk about welders, you talk about overworld trekkers, you know, those type of thing. You have a lot of demand, and I know that school districts are really under some demand from industry to offer these programs, but not only for students. Some of these programs are going to be expanded to offer lifelong learners the opportunity to come in, or people who need to, you know, brush up on their welding skills or their over-the-road trucking skills.
Just a few seconds left here. The Racing Commission director in the state is optimistic about the 2021 racing system.
Right. Now, last year, the tracks were open, but the attendance was down.
Right.
Except in Fargo at the horse park. The horse park did well. So now the director, Jack Schultz, is saying Chippewa Downs had a pretty good opening weekend. It wasn't quite what they expected, but they think with the nicer weather, they're going to get more crowds up there. And also they're expecting perhaps even record crowds at the Fargo Horse Park.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Ashley.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we are joined by Professor Joseph Ellis and the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson, and the two of them answer listener questions.
The eminent Professor Joseph Ellis, now retired and in an undisclosed location in Vermont, answers questions about Jefferson and the Haitian Revolution, Jefferson and his honeymoon and marriage to Martha Wales Skelton in 1772, and a question about the signers of the Declaration of Independence. How important are they, since most of them we don't know much about? Would it be in our interest to know more, or are they rightly obscure? And which of the signers of the Declaration are overrated and which underrated?
And their answers to that question may surprise you. Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Well, there's the fanfare. That means it's time to go off to the movies with Matt Olien. And Matt, you have gone to go see the latest in the, 101 Dalmatians story, Cruella. I guess I don't know if that's really how you would frame that. But, what's interesting to me already about Cruella is Cruella's always been played by an older woman. And now she's being played by somebody who's 5 years younger than I am. I'm not sure how I feel about, am I in the Cruella stage of life here?
Well, this is the Cruella backstory.
Okay.
So
we're still kind of
Disney,
young.
As you know, loves to do reboots and backstories, and they just keep making money hand over fist. I said years ago to someone, just invest in Disney. You'll never lose money. I know Disney World was shut down during
–
No,
I
did not. I know it's been shut down during COVID, but it'll reopen and people will spend – truckloads of money down there like we did with our kids. So this is the backstory to Cruella. And this is one of the strangest Disney backstory films I think I've ever seen. And when I say strange, it's the way the film is constructed, and I'll get to that. But also it's kind of this I still don't know if I like this movie or didn't like it. It's very seductive when you watch it. It's interesting. There's a lot of eye candy. But at the end – I was almost like, did I like that or didn't I like that? And I'm not really sure. So let me talk my way and walk my way through this, and maybe we'll figure out if I liked it or not. So it's a strangely constructed film because it's narrated by Cruella, Emma Stone, as kind of looking back on her life and how things get going and how she becomes an orphan and then meets Horace and Jasper, who are also orphan boys. That's how she ends up with Horace and Jasper, who, of course, she treats like garbage in the Dalmatian movies as her imbeciles and things like that. But at first, they're all kind of these like street urchin pals. They're like a little family, and those are kind of some interesting scenes. But what's strange about the film is it's set in the early 70s for some reason, and I'm not really sure why it's set in the early 70s. The original film came out in 61. So they use that early 70s motif to really kind of delve into the fashion world of London in the early 70s, kind of the mods and the rockers and the long hair and all that kind of thing. The film feels like an extended music video and fashion show. Every few minutes, all of a sudden, Cruella, Emma Stone, is walking around to a different song. These Boots Are Made for Walking, or a song by the Zombies, or a song by the Rolling Stones. And then they get into more 70s music like ELO. And it feels like I'm watching a music video and a fashion show, and I think that was their intention. Craig Gillespie, the director, does infuse it with some, nice quick editing and things like that. So it feels a little different than other Disney backstory films.
So that was okay, but I'm not really sure that's what I was expecting, was a long music video and fashion show. But the real problem with the film is it's too long. At 2 hours and 14 minutes, I kept waiting. Is this the climax? Oh, no, there's another climax coming. And I can't tell you too much about the plot because it basically involves the Battle of the Emmas, Emma Stone versus Emma Thompson. Emma Thompson plays a rich fashion designer, and Emma Stone, as Cruella, wants – Estella is her name. Her name is Estella first. That's her birth name. She wants to get into working for her in the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. And it sets up this rivalry between the two Emmas, Estella versus her employer, the Baroness, played by Emma Thompson. Both Emmas are great. They know how to choose scenery. They're superstars. They're both Best Actress Oscar winners. And it's really this battle royale between the two Emmas. Why it's a battle, you'll have to go see. There's a lot of backstory. There's a lot of stuff that isn't known about why she wants to work there at this fashion house. So overall, I guess it's a pleasant 2 hours and 14 minutes, but it was too long. And it's really interesting how they just basically shoved the music and fashion video down your throat. And the story is a little bit to the side. That's what I would say.
I don't want to give away any spoilers, but as I was watching the trailer, I was reading some of the comments, and a couple of the comments were something to the effect of, "Dear Disney, please don't Maleficent this, where you make it about a misunderstood hero. Please let her just be a bad villain." Can you answer anything about that without giving away spoilers?
I can. So in a film, usually you need someone to root for. Who do you root for in this film? Because Emma Thompson is a very seedy character as well as the fashion designer. And clearly we know how Cruella is going to end up. So I will say you're partly right. She needs to be misunderstood because we need someone to root for. That's about what I can say about that. Why she's misunderstood, you have to go see. But yes, if she's only the evil Cruella, we have nobody to root for in this film except maybe a couple of the dogs and Horace and Jasper, you know, who are just treated like bad employees by Cruella. But Emma Stone is a superstar. She has expressive eyes. She's great in the role. I give her a lot of credit. Emma Thompson is deliciously evil in her role, and the costumes and the makeup will probably be in the Oscar mix.
So back in the 90s, and I think again in the early 2000s, there was another woman who played Cruella, and she is a multiple Academy Award nominee, Glenn Close. Do you want to give me all of the time she's been nominated? And if you're really feeling frisky, you can tell me who won instead.
Okay, so Glenn is now 0 for 8 at the Oscars. She has tied the great Peter O'Toole.
Yeah.
And I believe an honorary Oscar will be coming in the next few years. So initially, she was nominated in supporting roles. Mm-hmm. The World According to Garp, 1982, losing to Jessica Lange for Tootsie.
Yep.
83, she was up for The Big Chill, losing to Linda Hunt for The Year of Living Dangerously. Mm-hmm. 84 for The Natural, losing to Peggy Ashcroft for A Passage to India.
Mm-hmm.
Famously, Best Actress nominee, Fatal Attraction, 87. That should have been the Oscar, but she lost a share for Moonstruck. I would have voted for Glenn. 88, Dangerous Liaisons, losing to Jodie Foster in The Accused. Okay, 2011 for Albert Nobbs. Is that right, Ashley? Losing to Meryl Streep for The Iron Lady. And then we had just this last year, of course, for Hillbilly Elegy, losing to Yoo Jung-yoon for Minari.
Mm-hmm.
And the eighth one, oh my goodness.
Just a couple years earlier.
The Wife.
Yes.
Losing to Olivia Colman for The Favorite.
That's just crazy. Do you remember what you had for breakfast?
Two Pop-Tarts.
We've been to the movies with Madeline.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 11th. On this date, in 1909, the State Line Herald reported on a huge event for the small town of North Lemmon. The Golmer Brothers Circus had arrived from Baraboo, Wisconsin. Every hotel and restaurant in town was full to capacity. 5,000 spectators filled the stands for the show. One local man saw the circus as a business opportunity. Nick Kurt had a team of flashy painted ponies. He was sure the circus would buy his team for an impressive price. On the morning of circus day, he hitched a team to a wagon, and three of his neighbors came along for the ride. They set off in high spirits, the painted ponies tied to the back of the wagon. Nick expected to come home with a pocket full of money. Nick, however, failed to consider what turned out to be a major obstacle. He had to cross the Cedar River. It was normally a rather sleepy little stream, but it wasn't sleepy on circus day, described as booming full and inclined to be disagreeable. Nick knew the circus tents were within an easy drive once he crossed the river. He was not about to let a couple of feet of water stand between him and the sale of his ponies. With determination, he urged his team into the water. It wasn't his best move. The water got deeper, and the current got stronger. The pulling team was swimming heroically, but the painted ponies were not helping as they began thrashing in the water and pulling back on the wagon that was now afloat. The wagon tipped over, with the driver and passengers thrown into the water. After a struggle, horses, ponies, and passengers all made it safely to dry land. Unfortunately for Nick, his efforts went for naught. He did get to put his fancy ponies through their paces, under the watchful eye of the Golmers, but they explained that, as much as they would like to have them, there was no more room in the train. The circus turned down the purchase. Nick Kurt returned home, his ponies still in tow. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
A debut album from one Wolfgang Van Halen. Yep, that Van Halen.
It's all just me, so I guess there's nobody to blame if things go wrong.
That, plus the G7, NATO, Putin, and the Queen, President Joe Biden, in Europe. Those stories Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, The One Thing You'd Save. It's the new book from children's author Linda Sue Park as she talks with students about the things that they would rescue in a fire and what the things we have say about who we are. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.